would ever need such a barrel. The detailed plans for its construction, carefully sketched by Mrs. Taylor on a plain piece of paper, were unlike anything that the West Bay Cooperage Company of Bay City, Michigan, had ever received before. The company normally turned out standard wooden kegs for the city's many breweries by the hundreds, but this order was different. It was for a single barrel to be custom made with extra thick staves of oiled Kentucky oak and reinforced with 10 iron hoops instead of the usual 6. Its size and shape were also highly unusual. A full 4.5 feet high and 3 feet in diameter, it was larger than the standard barrel and strangely tapered to be much narrower at its bottom than at its top. The specifications also included a 175-pound blacksmith's anvil to be bolted to the bottom and secured with 3 heavy iron straps. A seat and a leather harness were to be fastened on the inside, along with a rubber breathing tube attached to the hole near the top. No one dared challenge or question the special order made by Mrs. Annie Edson Taylor, the stern, no-nonsense owner of a local dance and music school, who looked like she could more easily win a fist fight than turn a pirouette. Mrs. Taylor was a dour widow who kept mostly to herself and was secretive about the details of her life. Rumor had it that she had traveled the country for years, teaching little girls to become refined young ladies, and recently had come upon hard times. But how could a strangely shaped and equipped barrel possibly help her? Employees at the West Bay Company likely wondered what she could possibly use it for. Perhaps to explore the bottom of the sea. When the barrel was finally finished, Mrs. Taylor assured the West Bay Cooperage Company that their payment would soon be forthcoming once she had successfully accomplished something no one had ever done before. She instructed the workers to transport the barrel to the local freight office and to be shipped to an address that offered a clue to Mrs. Taylor's true intentions. The Lafayette Hotel, overlooking Niagara Falls, New York. Welcome to Places of Legend, a podcast that digs into places with stories. Stories that are shared in schoolyards, on sidewalks, in urban legends, age-old superstitions, and internet memes. It's far from the history that is usually taught in school books. Let's call it cultural heritage with a weird and unexpected twist. The legends can be scary, they can be hilarious or grotesque, and the truth behind them is almost always hidden. Places of Legend offers up stories that pull back the curtain at famous historic sites around the country. Historic places with very different stories to tell. I'm Angela Labrador, and with my colleague and author Neil Silberman, we hope to turn your ideas about America's places of legend upside down. In this episode, our place of legend is an iconic magnet for tourists, honeymooners, and daredevils. A steep natural drop of more than 150 feet in the level of the Niagara River as it flows northward from Lake Erie toward Lake Ontario, the world-famous Niagara Falls. Long considered a sacred place by the Native American peoples of the Eastern Great Lakes, an awesome place of sacred wonder, it was the western gate for trade and warfare with the more distant peoples of the Upper Great Lakes. The first European explorers were awestruck by the sight and sound of millions of gallons of clear, cold water roaring over the edge of a high precipice in 3 separate falls, with thick mist rising from the crash of the waters below. Niagara, like the other magnificent features of the North American landscape, took on almost mythic scale in the descriptions and engravings of the explorers' reports. The Falls of Niagara remained a distant wonder for two centuries, at least until the opening of the Erie Canal in 1825. The image of Niagara Falls quickly morphed from that of a remote, unreachable natural marvel to a popular honeymoon destination and vacation spot. A visit to the falls was deemed to be therapeutic. In a clanking, hammering age of industry, the roar and rising mist of the Horseshoe Falls, the American Falls, and the Bridal Veil Falls were places where visitors could feel the rumble and be deafened by the roar of the sheer power of God's own nature that no mere human efforts could ever overcome. The awesome power of the Cascades, when seen from the observation platforms built at the top of the precipice, was hypnotic. Its fatal attraction was evident. Barges, fishing boats, and rafts that had drifted too close to the edge plunged to the gorge below to certain destruction and death. Suicides of jilted lovers and bankrupt businessmen became more common as the gray-green torrent beckoned to them. In fact, death and wonder, the most visceral of human feelings, soon became Niagara Falls' most valuable commodities. The thrill of the falls could be heightened by the spectacle of something or someone going over the raging cataract or falling into the furious whitewater rapids below. And from the late 1820s, there were a series of sensations. The first one, staged by a local hotel owner to attract more visitors by sending a salvaged old schooner filled with animals over the edge to their deaths. And in 1829, Sam Patch, the legendary jumper, leapt into the rapids beneath the falls and lived. Each one of these spectacles swelled the crowds of visitors who traveled to Niagara Falls just to witness the event. By the 1850s, tightrope walkers had become the most popular daredevils. A French aerialist, known as Blondine, crossed from the American side of the Niagara Gorge and back again, performing acrobatic stunts and even donning a chef's hat to cook an omelet along the way. The crowds were thrilled by tightrope walking daredevils who stood on their heads, mugged at the observers, and generally showed their contempt for the deadly torrent below. At a time when the country was being torn apart over the issue of slavery, Blondine and his American rival, the high wire walker William Hunt, who billed himself as the Great Farini, were among America's first celebrity superstars, vying with each other to perform ever more dangerous stunts. Crossing Niagara in some death-defying way was a sure path to fame and fortune, at least for those who survived. You might say Annie Edson Taylor was rootless, living on her own in rented apartments, moving from city to city on one-year contracts, stubbornly seeking some goal or source of satisfaction, always just beyond her grasp. Vain, headstrong, and fanatically class-conscious, she was born in the small river town of Auburn, New York, one of 11 children of a wealthy local industrialist, who died when she was just 18. After his death, she was sent away to boarding school, where she didn't last too long. She eloped with a local boy, David Taylor, who was killed just a few years later in the Civil War. From that time on, Annie lived a solitary life, made respectable wherever she went by her aristocratic demeanor and the diploma she had received after her husband's death from a New York dance and music conservatory. With the benefit of a trust fund left by her father, she was able to establish a series of private, if short-lived, dance studios over the next 30 years. By her own admission, she had traveled by train, stagecoach, and wagon 8 times across the entire country, teaching dance to young ladies in San Francisco, Chattanooga, Washington, D.C., Chicago, Birmingham, Indianapolis, and Syracuse. Whether the market was weak or her business skills were deficient, the schools rarely lasted more than a season or two. Finally, she ended up in 1899 in Bay City, Michigan, where the timber industry was booming, and she hoped there would be a good crop of businessmen's daughters to teach. But by the time she reached Bay City, at 61 years of age, her trust fund was exhausted, and as she later put it in her memoirs, "For 2 years, I had been constantly studying, when not occupied in teaching, what I could do to make money, and to make it honestly." The hallmarks of a burgeoning public performer could be found in the creativity of her financial tales of woe. Nothing was ever due to poor budgeting, always to some dramatic alleged catastrophe. She would tell anyone who would listen of how she was drugged by an anonymous intruder in San Antonio and robbed of $3,000. She would relate her encounter with stagecoach robbers outside of Austin and tell of the loss of another $1,700 to an unscrupulous stock agent in Tennessee. By the summer of 1901, in Bay City, Michigan, with her dance and music school closed and her bills mounting, Annie was desperate and almost destitute when she suddenly struck upon the idea. The Great Pan American Exposition was now underway in Buffalo, and the newspapers reported the unprecedented numbers of fairgoers taking the opportunity to visit Niagara Falls. "The idea came to me like a flash of light," she claimed, as if channeling a divine command. "Go over Niagara Falls in a barrel. No one has ever accomplished this feat." Edson's improbable stunt is a bit more complicated than a sudden thunderbolt from heaven, though it was certainly an extraordinary career turn. The idea must have been percolating ever since she landed in Bay City, for the idea of holding a Great World's Fair in Buffalo had been public news for at least 3 or 4 years. Certainly, there would be more tourists to nearby Niagara, but that was not the motivation that convinced Annie that a fortune awaited her at the foot of the Horseshoe Falls. The public appeal of daredevils at the falls had been resurrected. And this time, it included men in barrels, not only tightrope walkers and leotards. A man named Carlyle Graham was now the hero of Niagara. An Englishman by birth, and a barrel maker by trade, he was the first person to survive a passage through the violent rapids and dizzying whirlpools at the foot of the falls. After his first barrel ride in 1886, Graham successfully rode the rapids three more times in the following years. Other barrel riders soon joined a new daredevil competition. Names now forgotten, like Graham, George Hazlitt, William Potts, and Bobby Leach, became national idols. Crowds once again began to visit the falls, especially to witness life-or-death stunts, and avidly bought up souvenirs and postcards of the event. Carlisle Graham was dubbed the King of Mad Torrents, riding his bright red oversized barrel, weighted with an anvil at its tapered bottom, again and again. Celebrity in turn of the 20th century America, as now, meant money. And while the barrel men and occasional women concentrated on riding the Niagara River's dangerous rapids, none dared to attempt a descent over the falls themselves. That was the goal that the prim Mrs. Taylor aimed for to solve her financial plight. Even in her penniless condition, she was still concerned with propriety. But she was desperate, and as she recalled, "I did not think it wrong, as there was nothing immodest in the act, nor did it involve the life of anyone but myself." Moreover, she believed that God would answer her prayers and protect her, offering both a proof of divine power and a welcome gift of financial security from the public acclaim she would surely receive if she survived a barrel ride over the falls. So in August 1901, Annie Edson Taylor began her preparations by making a preliminary model of her barrel, cutting out staves made of paper and sewing them together with twine. When she was satisfied with the shape and space inside she would occupy, she took her plans to the West Bay Cooperage Company in Bay City to construct her customized barrel and ship it to Niagara. Unfortunately, when Annie arrived at the falls at the beginning of October, the public mood was a lot less upbeat than she had hoped. A month before, down in Buffalo at the Pan American Expo, President William McKinley had been shot by an anarchist at a public reception and had died of his wounds just 2 weeks afterwards. With the nation in mourning, Annie's public announcement that in just a few days she would attempt a descent to the Horseshoe Falls was greeted with public derision. This was not a time for daredevil stunts. Besides that, how could a staid, stout music teacher from who knows where, in her flowered hat and black gabardine dress, possibly survive a tumble over the roaring falls that had claimed hundreds of willing and unwilling victims over the years? Accompanied by her newly hired manager, a small-time carnival and vaudeville agent from Bay City named Frank Tussie Russell, Annie made her first public appearance outside the Lafayette Hotel to proudly display her ingeniously equipped barrel and proclaim her confidence to the crowd of curiosity seekers who had come to hear her speak. She believed that she had made every precaution for her own safety. In addition to the harness and anvil to keep the barrel upright as it hurtled over the precipice, she had wedged two mattresses and a pillow inside to cushion her during the shock of the fall. She also pointed out the breathing tube, firmly attached to the small hole in the barrel's exterior, that she could quickly seal with a cork when the barrel plunged into the deep pool at the foot of the Horseshoe Falls and was completely submerged. The crowd peered into the barrel with smirks of barely hidden disbelief. Some even murmured among themselves that this woman was obviously insane. Old-timers at the falls were convinced that the 63-year-old music teacher, who, by the way, adamantly insisted she was only 46, was about to commit a reckless, suicidal act. Just a few days before, a struggling actress and singer named Maude Willard had attempted to boost her own career by riding a barrel through the lower rapids, a closing act for which she paid with her life. Annie reluctantly admitted to a shouted question that no, she did not know how to swim. This was sheer madness. And when word spread of Annie's intention to go over the falls on October 24th, her birthday, local police sternly warned her agent that he could be arrested for voluntary manslaughter if he allowed his client to actually go through with the fatal stunt. But undeterred by the catcalls and official warnings, Annie was determined to become a public sensation and gain what she assumed would be financial security for the rest of her life. Just to be sure that her barrel was as sturdy as she believed, she had it launched for a trial run over the falls, with only her pet cat inside. When the barrel was retrieved from the foot of the falls only a few minutes later, the barrel was intact, and her cat, though badly frightened, was still very much alive. That was it. On the afternoon of her birthday, she hired some local boatmen to load her barrel onto a large rowboat about a mile upstream from the falls. Dressed in her familiar large lady's hat and black formal dress, she was helped aboard the rowboat, which drifted in the current, coming to rest on the shore of a tiny island where the final preparations for the descent would be made. Always the prim and proper gentlewoman, Annie asked the boatmen to avert their eyes as she took off her hat and wriggled out of her dress, donning a simple blouse and skirt in which she would go over the falls. She then crawled into the barrel, and the upper hatch was securely closed behind her. Then, following her explicit instructions, the boatman used a bicycle pump to force enough fresh air into the breathing hole to keep her alive during the drop and the complete immersion of the barrel into the roiling waters beneath the falls. When this procedure was finished, they pushed the barrel out into the river until it was carried away in the raging current, headed directly for the edge of the Horseshoe Falls. With several thousand onlookers crowded onto the shores of the falls and across the suspension bridge that spanned the lower gorge, the wobbling barrel carrying Annie Edson Taylor floated quickly downstream and went over the edge, weightlessly riding the falling waters down to the bottom of the torrent, landing with a crash. After 2 or 3 minutes, as the spectators craned their necks to see if the barrel had survived the 160-foot drop, it bobbed to the surface and was quickly retrieved by another team of boatmen below. When the barrel was towed to shore and opened, Annie emerged shaken, but alive. Still trembling from the experience, she told the gaggle of reporters who had rushed down to the shore to greet her how terrifying the experience had been. "If it was with my dying breath," she ruefully announced, "I would caution anyone against attempting the feat. I would sooner walk up to the mouth of a cannon, knowing it was going to blow me to pieces, than make another trip over the fall." Thank you. And so Annie Edson Taylor became a national celebrity as the first person to survive a trip over Niagara Falls. Though her fame lasted for more than the cliched 15 minutes, sadly, it did not bring her the fortune she had hoped. In the years that followed, she became a fixture among the honky-tonks, souvenir stands, and ice cream parlors on the American side of the falls, sitting behind a small table on the sidewalk with a large hand-painted sign that identified her as Annie Edson Taylor, heroine of Horseshoe Falls. But signing autographs, posing for snapshots with tourists' newfangled brownie cameras, and selling copies of her self-published pamphlet brought in a very meager income, especially after her erstwhile agent absconded with her barrel, displaying it for a fee which he pocketed at county fairs and sideshows throughout the Midwest. Annie was the first, but certainly not the last barrel jumper at Niagara, and as the years passed, her achievement was progressively overshadowed by new daredevils with even more spectacular stunts. Falling into financial destitution, she was eventually declared an elderly ward of New York State. And in 1921, at the age of 83, she passed away in nearby Lockport at the Niagara Infirmary. But her notoriety, if not her lasting fame, was acknowledged by the Niagara Falls old-timers, who gave her a proper burial in a special section of the Oakwood Cemetery within earshot of the roaring waters, reserved for the ragtag collection of people who had leapt or fallen to their deaths over the years. The inscription on her gravestone still bears witness to the only event in her life for which she would want to be remembered. Not her birth, not her death, not her career as a dance and music teacher. Just the words, Annie Edson Taylor, first to go over the Horseshoe Falls in a barrel and live, October 24th, 1901. In her own way, Annie Edson Taylor was a pioneer in the development of American popular culture. A self-made celebrity who sought lasting fame and an elusive fortune through a death-defying act of bravado. Whether it was motivated by economic woes or a desire for drama, Annie's barrel ride fed a public appetite for daredevilry and spectacle. And although Niagara Falls is certainly a spectacle to behold in and of itself, Annie's stunt made tangible, at least for a few minutes, for its thousands of spectators, the dance of death and the courage to cling to life despite all odds that unites us all. We hope you have enjoyed this episode of Places of Legend, a podcast in which we explore historic sites where the forgotten and unexpected meeting of past and present offers a new kind of heritage experience. Our aim is to share our curiosity about out-of-the-way places and forgotten events. And we invite you to visit our website at placesoflegend.com, where you can find maps, photographs, and links to further information about the sites we explore and the music heard in each show. In our next episode, we'll travel to the stylish winter playground of Miami Beach in the Roaring Twenties, when the narrow strip of sandy beaches and luxurious hotels was a gathering place for Hollywood celebrities and the nation's wealthiest elite. We'll tell the story of one of the era's most notorious jewel thieves, a stylish New Yorker who went by dozens of names and mixed unnoticed among the crowds of tuxedoed and bejeweled winter visitors. No violence, no confrontation, just an intimate knowledge of the social scene and when its wealthy members would be away from their hotel rooms. Diamonds, rubies, emeralds, and thick wads of banknotes were his spoils. We'll hear about his plunders, how the police tried to put an end to it, and how his legacy continues as Miami Beach lives on as a sun-drenched meeting place for the rich and famous, and for some of the world's greatest grifters and light-fingered jewel thieves. Until then, thanks for listening. And we look forward to joining you in discovering more places of legend, available on iTunes, Google Play Music, Stitcher, and on our website at placesoflegend.com.